Good morning to all of you. Ever since I was small, or in high school and in college, I've always been intrigued by the apparent incongruities in life. I am told a lot of things, but I see different things. I am told to believe in certain things, but what I observe in people would be different, such that I think, in common with most of us, grew up in an environment of conflict between what people say would be good or what we should believe in and what is actually happening to people in general. And this was an issue that I had to personally face for many, many years and to try to resolve these incongruities in life. And after I encountered the Theosophical Society and Theosophy, then I realized that there is an ageless wisdom on the transformational process from this stage of incongruity to harmony. So this morning, I'd like to share with you my understanding of the essentials of the transformative process. Why do we need transformation? It's the answer to me is very simple. It's simply because a lot of us are unhappy. We are in conflict, both within us and with our environment, and we feel unfulfilled about many things. The other reason is because the society and the world where we live in is in a mess. It is weighed down by crime, wars, conflict, greed, selfishness. And it is, in many ways, an unsafe world to live in. I looked at the meaning of the word transformation, and the thing that I gleaned from the use of the word is that it is a radical change. It is a thorough, automatic change, a kind of metamorphosis during the life cycle of an animal, including human beings. It is not simply a quantitative change or improvement, but rather a transformation from a certain state to another state that has a different quality. And this transformational change is vital for the future, not only of our own future, but future humanity in our effort to bring about peace and harmony, and it is also individually a prerequisite to self-actualization and spirituality. Now, I'd like to make use of certain diagrams just to illustrate the process, the stages, the evolutionary stages of animals to human and the need for certain transformational milestones or crucial points. Among animals, of course, animals are driven by instincts or instinctual drives, but there are animals which are endowed with a thinking capacity. I don't know whether cockroaches can think, but a lot of mammals do think, dogs and other things. They can even be taught how to count. So this addition of the thinking capacity in animals, I think, is a very important key transformational stage. And it distinguishes higher animals from what we might call lower animals. Then the next stage is the development of self-consciousness. This stage created a sense of responsibility, that I am doing what I'm doing, and I'm conscious that I'm doing it. Unlike, I presume, animals which do things without being conscious that they are personally doing these things. And this development of self-consciousness, I think, is a very crucial phase in the evolution of organisms. It developed in us a sense of virtue and sin because we are responsible, and therefore we are either good or not good. And this is, I believe, the meaning of the legend in Genesis about knowledge of good and evil, an awareness of doing something good and doing something not good. And in fact, the religious concept of eternal damnation is based on the idea that we are totally responsible for our actions, that we have full free will. Now, whether you think you agree or not, but we can only be totally responsible if we are totally free. And before I touch or comment on that view, I'd like to just add on one more stage, which is the development of rationality. Rationality has a certain quality of impersonality. It is able to see things as they are, and it is somewhat different from ordinary thinking, because ordinary thinking is often linked with drives, with our own survival needs, but rationality is a bit different. It looks at things as they are, and hence it is what we would refer to as impersonal, being not linked to our personal needs. And this development, I think, is a very important stage in the evolution of human beings. Now, at the turn of the century, the previous century, something came up which changed our understanding of the extent of our responsibility as human beings. And this is the scientific confirmation of the existence of the subconscious. Freud was not the first one, I believe, who was aware of this, but he was the first one who really put it in the area of psychological science. And the discovery, or the more formal enunciation of the existence of the subconscious, shows that we don't have full free will. We may sometimes be really free, but a lot of time we are not. And hence, we may not be fully responsible because we are driven by psychological drives, needs, fears, complexes, and so on. And later it was followed by another school of psychology, behaviorism, which even goes to the extent that we don't have free will at all, that all our decision-making processes are conditioned. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Skinner once said that if you give him 20 babies, after they reach 20 years old, he will give you anything you want. You want a criminal, you want a priest, you want a military person. He can condition anybody to become anything. And this insight, and there's a lot of truth to it, the nature of conditioning, is in reality so pervasive that a lot of the things that we think are free done are not actually being freely done by us. We are being driven by unconscious complexes, drives, needs, fears, and so on. And when we say, I decided to do this, actually, it's my subconscious drives which made me decide to do that. So, we discover that we are significantly controlled or imprisoned by our drives and conditioning. So we have here a conflict within us, and this explains a lot our quandary in life, because we are self-conscious, we are capable of rational thinking, seeing things more objectively, but at the same time there is something in us which is so, which is invisible, and yet so powerful that oftentimes it derails our rational capacity. So this is a problem in our attempt to become more mature. It is that part of us which is subconscious and which we are not aware of. And because of its internal conflict, fragmentation, conditioning, This derails our capacity to think clearly and to be objective in the things that we are seeing or evaluating. So now, our present transformational challenge, the thing that we faced, has two facets. The first one is our rational capacity. It is the first important key. It enables us to be objective. It develops in us a moral sense about what is proper, improper, what is right, and what is not. And it is the beginning of character, the ability to decide on what is ethical or what is not ethical. The second part, the second important key, is the development of self-awareness, self-aware of what? Basically about the impulses that arise in us from our subconscious. Part of it is conscious, but oftentimes we think we are consciously deciding when actually the subconscious is pushing us, and hence it is semi-conscious, but largely subconscious. There's a principle that what we are not aware of, we cannot control or manage. In other words, if I'm not aware, for example, of a certain prejudice I may be harboring about something, I may just decide on the basis of that prejudice without knowing that I am biased. I may decide not to go somewhere thinking that I made a decision when actually I'm afraid of flying or I'm afraid of something that automatically I just block it off and say, I don't want to do it. So it's not that I don't want to do it or I want to do it, but there's something in me that almost hypnotically pushes me to decide in one way or the other. This part on self-awareness is a very important element in integrating rationality and our other personality parts. For adults, for example, self-awareness is necessary to undo or recondition the conditionings that conflict with rationality and with reality, such as fear, for example. There are people who have certain irrational fears, and they make decisions on that basis. I know of an award-winning writer in the Philippines who would not eat noodles. The simple reason is because she has phobia of snakes. And whenever she sees noodles, she sees hoses, she sees the word S, it triggers a fear, a phobia that is irrational. And so she never touches the encyclopedia with a volume S because there are photos of it. But the photos are just papers. And we know that it's not dangerous, and yet she won't do it. So these kinds of subconscious impulses derail our rationality. And it is important that we should be aware of these things. Otherwise, we just become victims of these. For children, the conflicts and fragmentation can be prevented by proper upbringing and formation of tendencies and habits. It is not that we want to control or to condition like one of those, I think there are novels about a kind of scientific behavioristic for molding of young people to whatever we want them to be. It's not that. But either we do it consciously, deliberately, or society molds it for them. For example, if I leave my son or daughter to just be exposed to social environment, my son or daughter may develop a phobia of cockroaches or a phobia of certain belief systems that will actually imprison him or her. So instead of leaving him or her to grow up like that, I would rather guide him such that these fears would not be present. It is for this reason that in Golden Link College, which Tim mentioned, we are very conscious of this, and that the whole educational system should never be based on fear, either fear of competition, fear of teachers, fear of failure or failing grades, fear of humiliation. And the environment must not create this one. That's the reason why we don't have rankings, we don't have contests, because contests just create a feeling of low self-esteem, a feeling of fear of failure. And by providing an environment that would avoid this, we are helping prevent the unwholesome conditionings in a human being as he or she is growing up. So in every human being then, we find a very basic conflict. We did not invent it. We are born into it, whether it's from past life or the present life, but we have this kind of conflict. What is this conflict? We have been conditioned in many ways such that we develop habits, we develop tendencies, we develop opinions, fixed opinions, the tendency towards anger, irritation, and so on. And these are conditionings, and conditionings are certain fixed habits that we have, physically or psychologically. But we have the other tendency to rise above these things, which is first rationality, wisdom, and spirituality. But a lot of times, this higher level is in conflict with the lower ones. Whenever, for example, I see that I need to talk with somebody with whom I have a misunderstanding with, then I'm being rational. I'm trying to understand. But anger may prevent me from doing so. And so long as the anger is there, then my reason probably won't prevail. We have often encountered people who have very strong resentment and hatred towards somebody in the family. And for years and years, they don't want to talk with that member of the family. And so this kind of a relationship would last for a long time, sometimes even for a lifetime. But the moment this person is made aware of the anger and the resentment within them, and then it begins to surface and flows, then this resentment and anger gradually disappears until it completely disappears. And then suddenly this person would say, I'm ready to talk. I love him after all. I've heard this many times, from hatred and resentment to a feeling of love towards a stepfather, towards somebody else whom they have not been talking to for a long time, simply because the conditionings on the personal level have melted away and disappeared. And what emerges would be a very spontaneous, loving attitude towards people whom they had loved long, long time ago. So this conflict is a basic one which we are, all of us are facing, and which is a very crucial factor in the current transformational stage that we are all in. Now, all the spiritual traditions speak of this, I believe without any exception. Let me start by what H.P. Blavatsky, one of the co-founders of the Theosophical Society, wrote about this. She said, whatever differences are to be found in the various presentations of the esoteric doctrine, yet in every one of them we find the fullest agreement upon one point, the road to spiritual development. One only inflexible rule has been ever binding upon the neophyte, as it is binding now, the complete subjugation of the lower nature by the higher, the conditioned nature, the subconscious tendencies that we have. In the book Key to Theosophy, she says this, the duty of a theosophist is to control and conquer through the higher self, the lower self, to purify himself inwardly and morally. This is something which is well known in Christianity. Saint Paul often speaks to this, the conflict between the higher and the lower. And this is one of the statements he had in one of his epistles. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, But the evil I don't want to do, this I keep doing. Again, the basic conflict between our loftier nature and our conditioned nature. The conditioned nature is one of self-centeredness, selfishness, thinking about our own advantages. On the other hand, our rational and moral and spiritual nature is not do not have these tendencies. In the Catholic Encyclopedia, there are actually many sources, but I just chose this particular quotation. The fathers and the theologians distinguished three stages or states of perfection. And these are the purgative way, which is the cleansing again of the lower part of our nature, the illuminative way, which is when the higher nature has now been discovered, realized, or entered into, and then the unitive way, which is the final stage of union with, whatever you call it, God, reality, absolute, or the divine life. Now, in Islam, there is a concept of the greater jihad. It doesn't belong to one of the hadiths, the major hadiths, but it is a very popular one and started, I believe, in the 11th century. I think many of you are familiar with the two sources of scriptural authority of Islam. The first, of course, is the Quran, and the second is the hadith. These are the sayings of Muhammad. Now, in the 11th century, an author, Al-Khatib al-Baghdadi's, claims that there is another hadith which he introduced, and it is this. The Prophet, meaning Muhammad, returned from one of his battles and thereupon told us, "You have arrived with an excellent arrival. You have come from the lesser jihad to the greater jihad." And when he was asked what it was, he answered, "The striving of a servant of Allah against his desire," or nafs. Nafs are personalities or selves. So the smaller jihad, the lesser jihad, is fighting battles for one's religion. And the greater jihad is the fighting against one's own lower nature, the nafs. In the Dhammapada, in the Buddhist tradition, there is a well-known brief description of Buddhism. Not to do evil, to cultivate the good, and to purify the mind. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. We find there again the idea about purification of what? Our conditioned nature. Now, I think I added something else. Some of the well-known mystical writings of Christianity. One of them is the well-known work of St. John of the Cross about the dark nights of the soul. Some of you are familiar with it, are familiar that there are two dark nights. One is called the dark night of the senses, and the other is the dark night of the spirit. A higher dark night and a lower dark night. What is the lower dark night? The lower dark night is our struggle with our conditioned nature, our habits, our tendencies. And when we want to, when we are ready to abandon them, then we go through a dark night, a difficult period of struggle, such that we undergo suffering and pain. Then there is another well-known mystical work in Christianity. It's called The Cloud of Unknowing. And the basic idea in the cloud of unknowing is that before one can reach into the highest, enter into what you call God or reality or absolute, one must go into the cloud of unknowing. What is unknowing? It means that we must unknow. We must drop off all knowledge. In other words, our mental tendency to understand things, the intellectual aspect of our lives. But it also says that before we can go into that, we must go through the cloud of forgetting, which means that there are things in the world to which we are attached, things that we desire, things that we need, and we must go into this cloud of forgetting this, become non-attached to them. So this is the cloud of forgetting, which is again the letting go of our attachment to our lower nature. Again, it's the same theme over and over again regarding the conflict between our lower nature and our higher nature. So when these tendencies have been harmonized, unlike before when these lower levels are all in conflict with one another, but when this lower personality is harmonized, then we find that there is now very little conflict between our tendencies and the pursuit towards a more rational and a more spiritual, a wiser life. And this, I believe, is something that would be very important in the process of bringing up children. The minimization of influences and conditionings that would eventually be incongruent to a mature life, to a wholesome life, to a spiritual life. Now, what are these things in our conditioning that would cause conflicts? For example, in our simple physical habits, when I'm not in control of my physical habits, I have to wake up at 3, I cannot wake up. I have to stop smoking, I cannot stop smoking. In other words, the body has its own will and I'm unable to control it in accordance with my higher faculties like reason. Such that I may develop a lot of unwholesome habits like diet, not exercising and so on, that eventually it will become an obstacle to whatever higher or loftier pursuit I may wish to do in my life. Emotionally and socially, I may be impatient, prone to anger, fear, easily hurt, have a lot of attachments, as opposed to being calm, respectful, self-aware, has self-mastery, and non-attached. This middle part is, I think, one of the most potent obstacles to the higher life. It is so powerful, it can be so powerful, that after a certain age, it seems so difficult to remove them. And it is for this reason that this process, this transformational processes, must begin at a very young age. As far as possible, the sooner that we do it, the better. Mental habits, for example, we can have fixed and narrow habits of thinking, biases, mental lethargy, as opposed to being open, to being objective, being inquisitive, and so on. These are all parts of our habits, and they come under personality. So, in looking at what perhaps can be done in order to help individuals, especially young people, in growing up in a certain way such that there will be minimum of conflict, incongruities, fragmentation in the personality versus one's higher goals or higher ideals, there would be certain stages that we perhaps should look into. The first one, when children are very young, would be simply be habit formation. In other words, let children early in life be capable of taking charge of their physical habits and emotional habits and even mental habits. Up to the age 7, I think we will observe that young people are just copying what they see. In other words, they're not even consciously thinking about what they should become. They're just adapting to the world. And during those ages, they're just simply unconsciously developing and acquiring habits, which may become obstacles to their quest for maturity, or this can become congruent and supportive of the effort to be mature. Second would be general personality development, and this would include social habits, mental habits. And when we speak of personality, I'm referring to these three levels: the physical, the emotional, and ordinary thinking. For these, parenting and early schooling would be very essential parts of the development of these phases. I've given examples already a while ago, including physical habits, dealing with conflict. For example, dealing with conflict. A lot of children have been brought up by their parents such that whenever there are conflicts, they fight it out or argue it out, especially when they see that their parents themselves are shouting at each other whenever there are problems. We have observed among young children in our school that whenever they are shown alternative ways of dealing with conflict, like for example, if they get somebody else's pencil or bag and then doesn't want to return it, then we just ask him, if you have your own pencil, is it all right that I also grab it from you and keep it? And I would say no. And then we would tell him, if you don't want it that way, then your friend doesn't want it that way also. So if you'd like to have that pencil, can you return first the pencil and ask from me, can I borrow the pencil? We go through this kind of little scenario, and within about 10 or 15 minutes, they get it. And then they no longer behave in that way. They have developed the capacity of dealing with conflict rationally in terms of talking with each other rather than violently. And young children, I find, easily pick these things up and learn them, and it becomes a lifelong habit. Another example, the habit of anger. I don't know whether many of you are aware. Anger is a habit. Some people did not develop this habit. But at the same time, a person who doesn't have the habit of anger must develop an alternative. Because habit is something that arises out of frustration. You want something to happen, something done, and you're unable to do it. And out of frustration, you get angry. And out of anger, you start pushing people, shouting at people, and doing things that are actually very aggressive and harmful. In fact, anger has been called temporary insanity. And rage, whenever it goes to the stage of rage, one is truly insane. And a person who is in a state of rage can actually kill people and regret it later, but too late. In the process of trying to, when we are teaching children not to develop the habit of anger, we must also teach them alternative ways of solving issues or problems. And hence, anger can be substituted with effective problem-solving methods using reason and the habit of acting out based on decisions made. In other words, a person may know what would be the best solution to a problem, but the person may not have the habit of being able to pursue it to the end. In other words, the decision is not implemented because the body, the emotions, are not congruent with that decision. So this part of the decision-making process that will complete it, which is when once something should be done, the body and emotion should be able to follow as an entirety and not, again, as fragments. The next stage is the strengthening of rationality. All of us have this, except that oftentimes it is derailed. Let me just give some example. When there is improper or unwholesome personality development, then rationality does not function very well. I'll give an example. I teach certain classes in Golden Link in college, like comparative religion, self-transformation, theosophy. And One of the questions that often come up in our discussions is, does God repent? What do you think? Of course, behind this is the assumption that God is all-powerful and all-knowing. And it is evident that an all-knowing God will not repent, because you only repent if you make a mistake. In other words, you decide to do something and find out, oh, it's wrong. Sorry, I made a mistake. I regret having done that. And I noticed that a lot of college boys and girls are unable to mentally do this kind of integration. You know, 1 + 1 = 2 should be 2, but they go into 1 + 1 = 3. Because there is a kind of mental habit or fear, not wanting to go against certain authorities, and so they would say, yes, God can repent, not realizing that it is incongruent with his other assumptions. And it takes time for young people to be able to see the incongruities between rational thinking and authoritarian or conditioned thinking. But after about, let's say, 2 months of this, being open to adjustments, then they begin to realize the difference, and then their rational capacity becomes stronger. It takes some time for people to be able to integrate these two. Oftentimes, I will notice that there is a gap. There is a division between our rational capacity. It will work when it comes, let's say, to business, to mathematics or what, but when it comes to religion, then it doesn't seem to be operating. There is a division between the two, where rationality only works in one side, but not on the other side. But rationality should apply in all areas. I was impressed by what the sister was mentioning about one must be willing to explore the inconsistencies between one's core tradition and one's current belief or something. That capacity of openness, I think, is the one that can help lead us to what is true. But when we are not aware of this division or fragmentation, then oftentimes we become irrational in our decision-making capability. Rationality and reason and logic are impersonal, and when it is detached from conditioned biases, then it is capable of thinking clearly, logically, and sensibly. But rationality, as I mentioned earlier, does not function well when the personality is fragmented, saddled with push buttons. Push buttons are the conditioned reaction patterns of our emotions, mind, and even the physical body. When it is fragmented, internally inconsistent, dysfunctional, or neurotic. Hence, for rationality to be effective, personality must be wholesomely developed and responsive to reason. This is a long process, and for adults, it's a long process of undoing. For young people, it's a long process of building in an integrated manner. So after rationality, then character. Although I put it under as if there are steps or stages, but a number of them grow at the same time. But there are distinct features in each one which would be quite different from the others. Personality and rationality are important foundations of character. I often ask this question in a self-transformation seminar to the participants. I would ask, if your son or daughter is a contestant in a math or an art contest, whom would you like to win in the contest? Almost always, 95% of the case, the answer is my son or daughter. I'd like my son or daughter to win. And then I would ask a second time. I would say, but don't you also want that the best contestant should win, even if it's not your daughter or son. And they would immediately nod and say yes, and say, I don't know whether you realize that you have just changed your answer, so I'll ask you again. If your son or daughter is a contestant in an art or a math contest, whom would you like to win? And some would still say, my son or daughter. Most of them would say, the most deserving. And then later they'll realize that whatever their answer is, they always have a second answer. If I say, my son or daughter, I'd like my son or daughter to win, there's a part in me which says, but the most deserving should win. It is non-negotiable. It is something very evident. And for those who say that the most deserving should win, then I would ask them, isn't it that within you, there's something which still says, I want my daughter or son to win? In other words, we are a dual, our nature is dual. We have a personal, self-centered nature, and we have an objective nature that can see things as they are, reality. And these two are often in conflict. And so when personality and rationality are not well laid, then even character will be affected. Our moral judgments are affected by unconscious drives that would tend to protect our own self-interest, even if they're unethical. It's for this reason that even when it comes to character, all those prior dimensions must have been harmonized and taken care of. Character is a clear perception of what is right and wrong, helpful and destructive, good or evil. Eventually, I believe, after we have gone beyond a certain stage, these things don't matter anymore. Either good or evil, right or wrong, we go beyond a certain level that goes beyond this polarity of good and evil. It is a state of transcendence. But in the meantime, where we are, we have to deal with this, and this where character becomes relevant. But again, it must be integrated with the habits of the personality and not attached to our selfish interests. Now, in the process of developing these facets of our nature, we also discover something else. That when these four levels, habit formation, personality development, rationality, and character, are well laid in an integrated and wholesome manner, the person is automatically not only has self-mastery, but is a competent person in life. In fact, this is an important aspect in our educational system in Golden Link. That first, our first aim is not to produce graduates who will be good in certain jobs, like information technology or in education or what, but rather to produce graduates who are integrated, balanced, inwardly harmonized. In other words, these four levels are well developed. We are not there yet fully. It's a very difficult thing, and it depends upon the kind of teachers that we have. And so it is something that must evolve through the years. But we notice that individuals who are integrated, well-developed, with a clear sense of ethics, rational, and able to do what should be done without internal conflict, they become very effective in whatever work they do. Suppose they're graduates of, whatever, nursing, but they couldn't find a job in nursing. So you put them as an assistant in accounting, they'll do well. I have seen many people who graduated, let's say, in some technical subject, but went to sales or went to whatever, social work. They do very well in those areas because of what they are and not necessarily because of the skills that they have developed. And hence, I feel that in education, the development, the integrated development of this dual nature is very important, not simply for its own sake, which is for, you know, happiness, peacefulness, fulfillment in a person's life, but even for effectiveness in one's mundane life. Whether it's in one's profession, in business, in leadership, in parenting. And if we add to this the other faculty that is emerging, which is prajna or intuition, then it leads to wisdom and spirituality. So in the evolutionary processes that I've mentioned before, aside from self-consciousness, rationality, the next stage would be that of intuition. It's the next key transformative stage that I believe we will all be going through. And in this process, there are two kinds of awareness that must be nurtured in us. The first kind of awareness is a kind of personality awareness, awareness of fears, awareness of tendencies, awareness of habits, and for want of a better word, I'm using the word lower awareness. But there is another kind of awareness, which is higher awareness, which belongs to our impersonal nature, that of our rational nature and our intuitive nature, which sets the ground for the spiritual life. And when these are well developed, we go into that state of integration, the development of what Carl Jung speaks of as the larger self with a capital S, as opposed to the smaller self or the persona or the ego. It is self-actualization of Maslow. And then after that, then a state of transcendence, which is the theme, the apex of all mysticism. And that the mystical life really starts when the intuitive, or prajna, the intuitive nature begins to flower, and the whole process is what we speak of as this mystical life. Let me just relate this now to our theosophical framework about the nature of a human being, from our physical, emotional, lower mental, higher mental, transcendent consciousness, and higher self. And we'll find that in the development of an integrated nature, then each of these stages or levels would play an important role. And for this reason, we cannot neglect even our physical habits, because we'll have to, in college, we speak about back subjects. If I fail a subject, I cannot graduate. I have to go back and finish that subject. So whenever we have still things in our subconscious and habits which have not been ironed out, then we'll have to go back and deal with it. I think it was Meister Eckhart, or Saint John of the Cross, who said that in order for a bird to fly, then it must not be tied. But if the bird is tied even with the flimsiest of thread, it still cannot fly. And hence, even that small thread must be broken loose so that the bird can fly. So the smallest quantity of incongruities in our personality must be eventually worked out, sooner or later. If not this life, in future lives, but it's still something that we must attend to in our spiritual life. This is also represented by our two triangles, the higher triangle of the individuality and the lower triangle of the personality. And that when these two are harmonized, then we have the symbol of the six-pointed star, where the higher triangle is dominant and the lower one is an integrated but harmonious part of this whole. These stages would lead to what we speak of as self-realization. And in these stages, the first four stages, I believe, can be taught or developed or nurtured systematically. But the other one is something that can only be nurtured and not be, it's not subject to molding. It will flower when the soul is ready. And hence, the most that we can do, that one can do, is to provide the environment. But the critical element lies within that person and not outside. in all these processes, there are a lot of influences from birth until death, all these things which help mold us. And there are three parts, three of these influences which we can do something about. But the other three we can hardly do anything about. The first one would be parents, the influence of parents. This is so important and so basic. I've known of many young people, and of course adults, whose lives have become dysfunctional because of what the parents have done to them. And in some cases, when they have become adults, they no longer see life as life, but rather as a rebellion against their parents. Almost everything is seen with that colored glass about resentment or hatred against somebody. So parenting is very important because during the formative years of a person, the parents are so important in the creation of fragmentations and conflicting factors within the person, or the absence of these, and the capabilities in the personality that will be helpful for self-development. The second would be schools. The schools would be the second environment deliberately designed in order to help guide young people towards the adult life, the mature life. Unfortunately, at least in the Philippines, most schools are designed for jobs. In other words, all right, you be good in math, you be good in science, so that when you graduate, you become a good accountant, you become a good computer programmer, and so on. And I feel that this is a misunderstanding of what true education is. True education should be education for life, not simply for skills. And that the most important foundation of a mature life should be an integrated individuality and personality upon which we build skills, abilities, knowledge, and so on, as applied to the outside world. The skills are actually a temporary thing. If we lived, let's say, in the 16th century, the thing that we need to learn would be very different from what we are going to learn now. But the most important part is having the right qualities as a human being. And this, I believe, is the most important role of education. Then the third one would be the spiritual environment. This can be books, this can be organizations, this can be spiritual movements, lectures, and other things, which is based on an understanding of the ultimate purpose of a human being, of human life, to become mature, self-actualized, to reach our highest potentials. And these three factors are things that people can design and do something about. The other three, media, society, and government, we hardly have any control over. It's so complex, it's so vast, that they will just be what they are for, I don't know, centuries and centuries. And hence, it seems important that those who are involved in the transformative process must undertake efforts such that these first three would become more potent influences in the processes of growing up among young people, as well as in the growth of even of adults. And right now it's a minority, but hopefully with the efforts of like-minded groups and people, then schools can be established for this purpose, and then spiritual groups will be more, would abound and reach out to more and more people. And eventually even media and society will begin to be influenced by them. I believe that this is the work not only of the Theosophical Society, but of all movements, all individuals who are concerned about the maturity, self-actualization, and spiritual development of people. And I take it that it is our task for a long, long time within the Theosophical Society and outside of the Theosophical Society. Good morning to all of you.